Welcome to the Digital Identity Digest, the audio companion to the blog at Spherical Cow Consulting. I'm Heather Flanagan, and every week I break down interesting topics in the field of digital identity, from credentials and standards to browser weirdness and policy twists. If you work with digital identity but don't have time to follow every specification or hype cycle, you're in the right place. Let's get into it. Welcome back. If you've followed me for any length of time, you know that I'm a huge fan of open standards organizations, even as I challenge what open actually means, which is something I wrote a blog post about last year. But as much as I love standards effort that don't gate participation or the free use of their standards, you can't ignore the big players in the standards space, which brings us to today's topic, the International Organization for Standardization, ISO, and the International Electrotechnical Commission, or IEC. If you're working in digital identity, wallets, or credential formats, you're going to run into ISO and ISO/IEC work, whether you mean to or not. So let's talk about what those organizations actually are, why they operate the way they do, and why the experience can feel very different from the more open standards bodies many of us are used to. But first, a quick trivia break, because standards people do love their trivia. The three official names of the International Organization for Standardization in English and French and Russian do not produce an acronym ISO. Instead, the founders deliberately chose a short name deriving from the Greek word isos, meaning equal, specifically to avoid privileging any one language. Neutrality taken a bit far? Possibly. But it does tell you something about the mindset of the organization from the very beginning, and either way, the name stuck, and here we are. So ISO was established in the late 1940s in the aftermath of World War II, during a period when global coordination around industrial standards was becoming really important. And today, ISO includes 175 national members, have published more than 26,000 documents, including standards, and coordinates the work of hundreds of technical committees and subcommittees. And that scale is worth thinking about. ISO is not actually a single organization in the way many people expect it. It's better understood as a network, specifically a network of national standards bodies. And that structure explains a great deal about how ISO behaves. Participating in ISO does not typically happen at the individual level. It doesn't even happen at the company level. Instead, engagement usually flows through your country's national body. ISO formally calls these member bodies. The IEC uses the term national committees in joint work. The ISO/IEC directives usually use the term national body. Now, in plain English, though, it all comes down to the same thing. Your country is the gatekeeper here. Now, depending on where you live, engaging through that system may feel fairly straightforward, or it may involve more political administrivia than you perhaps expect. Your mileage is absolutely going to vary here depending on where you are in the world. Now, one of the more fascinating things to me about ISO is just how wide the scope is. I mean, they cover everything from fire classification for building codes to clean room particle measurements to the measurements of the thread on a screw. All of this is like, it's just completely across the board, and they also include a fair amount of technical work as well. I mean, ISO is fundamentally industry infrastructure. Technology standards are just one slice of that much larger portfolio. But if you work in technology, and especially in digital identity, you've probably noticed that you rarely see just ISO. You see ISO/IEC. And to understand that slash, we need to look at ISO's longstanding partner, the International Electrotechnical Commission. The IEC is actually older than ISO. It was founded back in 1906 when electricity was very much in, we'll call it its expansion era, and global coordination on its use was becoming really urgent. Early IEC work focused on terminology, on symbols, and on machine ratings, the kind of foundational plumbing that kind of enables global interoperability at a very, very basic level. If you've ever appreciated that electrical measurements and symbols are broadly consistent worldwide, you can thank the IEC for a good portion of that stability. That's why a volt is a volt. At a high level, the division of labor between ISO and IEC is fairly clean, right? ISO covers a very broad range of industries and domains. IEC focuses specifically on electrical and electronic technologies and tends to operate at a much deeper technical level within that space. Formal joint work between the two organizations dates back to the mid-1970s, and today their collaboration is mostly visible through shared technical structures that underpin much of the modern IT standardization in the world. Now, from a practitioner's point of view, participating in the IEC is broadly similar to participating in ISO. The IEC works through national structures, much like ISO does. If you want to contribute, the official guidance is to contact your country's IEC National Committee, which appoints experts to participate in the technical work. In the United States, for example, ANSI serves as the ISO member body and administers the U.S. National Committee to the IEC. So while governance details differ, IEC is not actually a shortcut around the national body model. The practical experience in getting involved is usually more alike than not. Now, once you get inside the ISO and the IEC ecosystem, the structure definitely gets a little bit complicated. Technical committees are established through each organization's governance processes, typically in response to proposals from national bodies or other major stakeholders in the system. From there, committees can spin up subcommittees, working groups, and various supporting bodies to carry specific pieces of work forward. Some of these groups are long-lived. Others are intentionally temporary and dissolve once their task is complete. None of this layering is accidental. The details vary across ISO, IEC, and then the joint ISO-IEC work, but the overall pattern is fairly consistent that the system is very deliberately structured, very deliberately formal, and very deliberately built for long-term coordination. And that carries straight into the joint bodies like the JTC1. As a side note, if you want to get sort of a concrete feel as to just how structured the ISO environment can be, which will look a lot like the IEC environment and will look a lot like the joint work environment, there's a participant training guide called My ISO Job, and that's worth looking at. So while the IEC and joint work does follow their own directive sets, the guide does give pretty useful sense of the kind of procedural rigor and the terms that you might expect in those environments. So, if you work in digital identity or broader IT standards, there is one structure that you absolutely need to know about in this whole big mess of standards efforts, and that's the ISO/IEC Joint Technical Committee for Information Technology, or JTC1. This is where most of the ISO/IEC technology work lives, and it does include a lot of the identity-relevant efforts. Under JTC1 sits numerous subcommittees focused on specific domains. For identity practitioners, some of the most relevant work has historically happened in areas like SC17, SC27, SC37. And this is also where work such as the ISO/IEC 18013-5, 18013-7 for mobile driver's licenses live, the ISO/IEC 29115 on identity insurance, and the ISO/IEC 23220 on digital wallets. Note that I relied heavily on the numbers there because if you actually look at the title of an ISO specification, it sometimes takes three lines to cover it all. They're very descriptive. If your product roadmap touches on government identity wallets, biometrics, regulated credentials, odds are pretty good that the JTC1 work is going to matter to you. One thing that surprises many, many people, especially those coming from consortia or open source communities, is how work from outside the ISO/IEC ecosystem sometimes appears under that banner. Within JTC1, one of the key mechanisms is the publicly available specification, or PAS, and its transposition process. Now, at a pretty high level, PAS provides an accelerated path, doesn't necessarily mean fast, just means faster, for externally developed specifications to become ISO/IEC international standards. Instead of starting from scratch inside JTC1, an approved external organization can submit an existing specification for ballot and potential adoption. This is not a free-for-all. Organizations must first be approved as PAS submitters in the first place. The submission package will include the specification text, the supporting material to help national bodies evaluate what's being proposed, and the work still has to survive the JTC1 ballot process. The PAS creates a bridge between sort of that consortium work and the national body standardization, but once something has transposed into ISO/IEC, The maintenance expectations and governance models can look very different from the originating community. So for readers who have watched their standards organizations go ISO, the PAS is often a really important piece that you should think about for the long-term ramifications of that direction. Now, every standards body does have to answer the same question: how does the work get funded? ISO and IEC are no exception. While both emphasize, you know, consensus and global expert participation, there's also that underlying economic model that shapes the behavior across the ecosystem. Both organizations place significant weight on the value of their published standards and, in some cases, on the conformity or certification ecosystems that surround them, particularly in the regulated and industrial sectors. This is where they get most of their money to fund the massive secretariat overhead that they have to function. I mean, even when work is being jointly developed in ISO and IEC, that those institutional economics do not disappear. Now, that financial reality does influence document access, participation patterns, and how quickly different communities can engage. I wouldn't say it's unique to ISO or the IEC, but it is an important piece of context that you need to take into consideration as you're trying to figure out what to do with these specifications that you cannot ignore, but you might not want to pay for, but you might have to. Now, on paper, ISO and the IEC provide very clear pathways for engagement through national bodies. In practice, that experience can vary significantly depending on how any given country structures its mirror communities and delegation processes. Some national bodies actively encourage broad expert participation. Others rely more heavily on formal membership, nomination, or other delegation structures. The result is that the on-ramp is not uniform across countries, and it's not always obvious from the outside. Honestly, I'm not even going to try and document that. There's probably 170 different ways that that actually can happen. Doesn't make participation then impossible, but compared to open standards environments, it's very rarely a simple and easy task. So why does this matter now, right? For many years, teams working on digital identity could focus most of their attention on the open standards bodies like the IETF or the W3C and their work on OAuth, the verifiable credential ecosystem, or like OpenID Foundation's OpenID for verifiable presentations work. However, as digital wallets, mobile credentials, and regulated identity systems move towards national and cross-border deployment, that ISO and IEC work is showing up much more directly in product roadmaps. So identity architects and product leaders are increasingly operating at an intersection of multiple standards cultures, each with its own expectations, timelines, and participation models. So understanding how the ISO and IEC actually work, not just in theory, but actually, how are they supposed to be functioning, becomes just as important as understanding the IETF, the W3C, the OpenID Foundation, and any other standards organization that you see. So wrapping up, ISO and IEC, both individually and through their joint work, are unavoidably the cornerstones of global standardization, but they operate on a participation and governance model that looks very different from many open standards bodies. And that is extremely uncomfortable for those of us used to a, comparatively speaking, less formal participation process. That said, love it or hate it, ISO, the IEC, and JTC1 exist at a level that is well above my pay grade. International politics absolutely impact the process more obviously than you might see in other standards organizations. So best be familiar with it so you know what you can expect when you do have to start engaging with the people in those standards efforts. And be patient, because this is a bit massively complicated and time-consuming area to spend your time. There's a lot of links in the written post. You might want to refer back to that if you've got questions or want to find some of the documents that I've referred to. And with that, I hope you have a great rest of your day. And that's it for this week's episode of the Digital Identity Digest. If it helps make things a little clearer, or at least a little more interesting, share it with a friend or colleague and connect with me on LinkedIn at HL Flanagan. And if you enjoyed the show, do be sure to subscribe and leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find the written full post at sphericalcowconsulting.com. Now stay curious, stay engaged, and let's get these conversations going.